Here, in this talk, I've tried it before, and there can be either no questions or a lot of questions, right? And I'd like to take them at the end, please, right? When there's a chance so there's a chance of finishing. If the universe is a quantum mechanical system, then it has a quantum state. That state is a necessary part of any final theory, just as much as the dynamics is. And it's what a theory of that state is the objective of quantum cosmology. Now, I want to stress right here at the beginning that when I'm talking about a state of the universe, I'm talking about the quantum mechanics of cosmological four-dimensional histories. The state is, therefore, not an initial condition in some space-time, right, predicting probabilities of what goes on there. Rather, the state predicts probabilities of alternative space-times as well as what goes on in them. The question I hope to address in this talk is, can the quantum state of the universe predict probabilities for local observations in histories with eternal inflation without a further measure? My answer to this will be yes, right? And certainly in a class of simple models that I'll discuss, the quantum state already supplies probabilities for histories. For well-defined questions, there shouldn't be any need for anything further. This is based on five assumptions, which I'll make. First of all, the quantum state, as I just outlined. Specifying the probabilities for alternative coarse-grained histories of the universe. Quantum space-time, I'll assume, meaning an ensemble of alternative classical histories, which is are the particular histories I'll aim at, with probabilities that are determined by psi. Quantum observers, meaning observers in a simple model as physical systems within the universe that only have a probability to exist in any one Hubble volume, and a probability, therefore, in very large universes to be replicated in many different places. I'm going to focus completely on our observations and not on the large-scale structure of the universe with probabilities in a Hubble volume, which are conditioned, as Bohr said, right, on a description of the observational situation. And to do that, I'm going to use adapted coarse grainings, that is, coarse grainings that focus, follow the observations and what they might be, and ignore unobservable features of the universe, such as its structure on very large scales. The talk will be in three pieces. First, I'm going to start with a kind of pedagogical introduction in a very simple class of models that won't have any gravity or fields in them. I'll call them box models. Just to discuss how we calculate probabilities for observations. Then I'm going to talk about cases where we have one minimum, where we'll learn how to calculate the probabilities for alternative classical histories from a wave function in the universe, the histories that exhibit eternal inflation. And finally, I'll try and say something about a toy model landscape where there are many minimum. So first, the box models. So consider a universe that has two possible configurations of Hubble volumes. So we imagine these to be different histories of the universe, one and two. History one has a bunch of Hubble volumes in it, all of which are red. Right? The alternative is that they might be blue, but in this particular simple model, they're all red. And another history with N2 boxes that occurs with probability P2, in which all the boxes are blue. Now, we're interested in probability of what we would observe, given that we might live in one or the other history. And so I need a quantum mechanical model of the of an observer. Observers were certainly particular physical systems within the universe with only a probability to exist in it. We're not certain to exist. Probability to exist in any one Hubble volume. In a very large universe, there's a certain probability, if a universe is sufficiently large, if there's a probability for us to exist, there's a probability that we're replicated. So, for example, you could have a universe like this, where you have many different Lennys in it, it's a sort of sobering prospect, but I think it follows naturally from the model. So I'm going to assume a very simple model for the observer where the observer only has one degree of freedom, existing or not existing. That, of course, is way too simple, and there's a probability PE for existence. It's way too simple, but it's more realistic than most. PE includes, of course, the probability for 3 billion years of biological evolution, the accidents that occurred therein, and is therefore very, very small. We have no hopes of calculating it, but we can use the fact that it's sufficiently small to derive some results, as I'll show you. So the question for observation is, what is the probability that we see red? So I'm going to make a typicality assumption, which is slightly different from what other people have meant by typicality, which is to assume that if there are a lot of instances of these identical observers, we're equally likely to be in any one. Some typicality assumption like that is required. This is the simplest one. The probability that we see red is the probability that we're in the history with all the red boxes, obviously, in the simple model. But this is not the probability that the history with the red boxes occurs, because the history with the red boxes could occur with no observers. In that case, if we existed, we would see blue. So rather, the probability that we see red is proportional to the probability that one occurs, the red boxes, with at least one instance of D, which could be us. The probability that there's at least one instance in history K, which would be one or two, is 1 minus the probability that there are no instances of E, which is 1 minus the probability that each Hubble volume doesn't have an observer in it raised to the power of the number of Hubble volumes. Can I take the questions at the end? We have to go through Lenny again. I'm about to calculate the probability that we see red, and it won't be. Here it is. So the probability that there's at least one instance of E is this, and therefore the probability we see red is the probability of 1 multiplied by the probability that there's at least one instance, which is this, or the probability that we see red is equal to P of 1, the probability that 1 occurs, multiplied by this weighting, which we call top-down weighting. If you're going to calculate conditional probabilities for observations, the top-down weighting is not a choice. It follows, it's an inevitable consequence of treating the observers as quantum mechanical systems. Could I please ask that you make the comments at the end? Okay. So there are a number of important limiting cases, right? There are two limiting cases. One is, as far as the probabilities are concerned, one is that the probability is so, PE times N is so small that we're rare in the universe. The probability of occurring twice is essentially negligible. The other case is when the number of volumes is so large that PE times N is bigger than 1, in which case we're common. We occur in many different places. The probability that we see red is given by this. And if we're rare in both cases, that is, PE times N1 is small and PE times N2 is small, that is, if the number of Hubble volumes in both histories is not very big, then the probability we see red is just given by this, because we can expand that out. And this gives us N times PE. So this is N1 P1 times divided by this normalization factor. And that's what's called volume weighting. It favors large N. Another limit that's of interest is if one of the histories has a large volume and the other history has a small volume, or a small number of Hubble volumes, the probability that we see red, if you just then calculate, is just P1 times divided by P1 plus a small volume like this, which is approximately equal to 1. So the probability in that case that we see red is approximately equal to 1. Suppresses small n, right? So the Hubble volumes, when you have a small number of Hubble volumes, are suppressed relative to the one with large Hubble volumes. That's going to be important in eternal inflation because we'll see that it favors eternally inflating histories. Finally, both of them could be big. In that case, the n's just drop out because if these are very large, these are all just 1. And so we get the probability that we see red is approximately equal to P1, and there's no top-down weighting at all. In all three of these limiting cases, PE cancels out, right? Which means we have a well-defined problem. That's a very simple model. I'm now going on to a slightly more complex one, where we have two kinds of Hubble volumes, histories K1 and 2, and in each history, the Hubble volumes have a probability of being yellow or green. I'm going to assume that there are an infinite number of boxes in these models. So we're in the common limit, where the numbers are all very large, and then calculate the probabilities for histories. The probability of any particular fine-grained configuration of yellow or green is the probability of the history times the probability that the number of boxes that are yellow times this probability times the number of boxes of green times this. And if those numbers are large, the probability is 0. So physical alternatives, when you have an infinite number of cases like this, have to be coarse-grained just to get probabilities that are not 0. So probabilities are then the sums of the infinite number of fine-grained histories in each coarse-grained one. So now let's ask the analogous question, what's the probability that we see yellow? We could do this in several different ways. Calculating, we could use a cutoff, right, to make the number of boxes finite and then calculate as before. But this leads to ambiguities, right, you find from the ratio of N1 to N2, which isn't defined as both of them become infinite. You can, however, calculate directly using a coarse grain that follows the color only in one box, R box, which could be any of the boxes, and ignores the other by summing over the probabilities of whether they're yellow or green in all the other boxes. Of course, summing over yellow and green, since the probabilities add up to 1, just gives you 1 times 1 times 1 times 1 times all the ignored boxes, and the result for the probability that we see Y is the sum over the different histories times the probability that a box in that history is yellow or green. And we could put in cutoffs and do it, but we can assume a finite number of boxes, but it's ambiguous to take the limit in this case because the probabilities of all these histories are 0. So a useful trick is to not sort of try to sum them up and then coarse grain, but coarse grain first and then take the limit. And then you get a well-defined fine result. So coarse graining is both necessary, because the probabilities of the histories are 0 in general, and therefore it's the key to finiteness and also to definition. And that requires not just one history of a classical spacetime, but of course an ensemble of them to coarse grain over. You can do more general models, for example, in the model I just gave you, the model assumes that all the Hubble volumes were statistically the same, so in the sense of having the same probabilities for yellow and green, but there could be some other property, J, on which the probabilities of yellow and green depend. For example, being in one kind of bubble or another, and then the probability is just more complicated. It's the probability of the histories and the probability that you're in a particular situation, J, times the probability for yellow, K, given J and K. So that's all the I want to say about these box models. Now I'm going to go on to the case where we have one minimum. So I'm going to assume that we have a scalar field, phi, that's moving in a potential v equals 1/2 m squared phi squared, as the simplest possible case, a quantum state, which is the no-boundary wave function, just as a model, right? We're not necessarily asserting that that was engraved on the backside of the tablets of Moses. And from psi, I'm going to try to derive the bottom-up probabilities for the ensemble of homogeneous isotropic classical background histories labeled, which will turn out to be labeled by the value phi naught. They start up at the potential and roll down. Those are the analogs of the PK in the particular models. Then I'm going to add linear fluctuations to this, calculate the linear fluctuations by the same method, discover that they get large, right, for fluctuations that left the horizon during the regime of eternal inflation, and proceed accordingly. So first of all, and I'm going to start by running through this just in a completely qualitative way, right, and then later make it more concrete, because I think based on the previous set of models. So there's a regime of eternal inflation when there's a regime in the potential where v cubed is greater than v prime squared. In that regime, standard results show that fluctuations that leave the horizon during that period grow and make the universe inhomogeneous on superhorizon scales. We didn't do that calculation. Other people did that calculation. The constant density surfaces thus become large in the regime of eternal inflation, and therefore top-down weighting suppresses the histories that don't have eternal inflation relative to ones that do. And so we favor histories that have eternal inflation, and for those, top-down equals bottom-up, and we can forget about the top-down weighting once we've made that selection. These large fluctuations, right, give rise to, and this is, we're basing ourselves on that Senator Torrey talked about yesterday, on calculations like in Cremonelli et al., which showed, claimed to show that the volume of the reheating surface is actually, has a finite probability for being infinite. So certainly it's very large, and that gives rise to, if we take a slice through that, to this characteristic mosaic structure, right, where you have inflating regions and not inflating regions. So we're not in any disagreement on that. We're only proposing a different way of calculating. Okay, so we selected at this point for, by just calculating the probabilities, for eternally inflating histories. Causality, elementary causality implies, I think, that observations today don't depend on what will go on in the future. Questions like how far we are away from the Big Bang or from the beginning of inflation, what patterns we might observe in the CMB, what bubble collisions we might observe, all refer to what happened in our past light cone, not to what happened in our future light cone. So we may like to calculate probabilities for future histories, but we should coarse grain some over all the alternatives in the histories in order to get probabilities for our observations today. A little tour through non-relativistic quantum mechanics might help with this. Non-relativistic quantum mechanics, if you have a state psi of a particle, say, moving in space-time, onto a set of, you might be interested, say, in what's the probability that the particle is in a certain set of range. Let's suppose our time is T1, and we're interested in the probability of time T1. The probability to be in range alpha 1 is the projection operator down under that range at time T1. I'm working in the Heisenberg picture, psi squared. Now, we could calculate that by first calculating what happens in the indefinite future by adding more projections, alpha 2, alpha n. Then we get the calculations for an entire future history, and then we could sum over those, and then it's an elementary calculation to verify that if you sum over what happened in the future, you just get back to the probability P alpha 1. So it's easier and more secure to calculate directly in quantum mechanics the probabilities for what happens coarse grain probabilities now by ignoring the future right from the start. Same messages in the rest of it. Coarse graining in this non-relativistic case is inevitable because if you extend the histories all the way to infinity by adding more and more projections, the probability of them goes to zero. Because each time you add a projection, the norm of the projected state is shrinking. So in the end, if you have an infinite number of them, you'll get zero. So bundling the histories together, coarse grading them, is necessary to get non-zero probabilities, and for that, more than one history is needed. So as long as you're forced to coarse grain just to get non-zero probabilities, why not coarse grain to the situation of interest, which is the observations in one Hubble body? Okay. Now I'll try to put this in more detail. I'm going to use the no-boundary wave function as a model for the quantum state, determining the probabilities that are analogous to PK and also the probabilities for what we see in any one Hubble body. I'm going to implement it. I don't have much time to describe it for you in all its beautiful detail. But so I'll implement it just in a mini-superspace model. In a mini-superspace model, I'm going to assume that we have, first of all, homogeneous, isotropic, and closed, spatially closed. So the metric is like this. I'm going to assume for the matter that we have a cosmological constant lambda, which enters into this conventional normalization, and the field is moving in a quadratic potential like this. And I'm going to assume, of course, the low-energy effective theory of gravity to do the calculation because where the action is this, plus surface terms, the scalar curvature, the cosmological constant, the Planck scale, because we don't have the techniques to do something better. The particular wave function I'm talking about, the no-boundary wave function, in this context will be the arguments that determine a three geometry and three-dimensional matter field configurations. So in this simple model, we have only the scale factor, right? And we have the scalar field, which is homogeneous over the three sphere. You're then instructed to take the Euclidean action for whatever theory you have, integrate it over all values of the scale factor and the scalar field, all histories of those that are regular on a disk, right, that has had only one boundary, that's the no boundary part, and match to B and chi on the boundary. You have to choose a complex contour to do that so that the integral converges and the result is real. That's the rotation of the conformal factor. Okay, then we try to calculate classical spacetimes by just, this is a sort of large story here, but the end result is it may be that in some regions of B and chi, that integral is approximated semi-classically, in which case it's given by... Now, the saddle points will, in general, be complex. We're just doing an integral. Nobody promises saddle points would be real. So the semi-classical approximation to leading order in H-bar would be given by the action evaluated at the complex saddle point, which will have a real part and an imaginary part. That's a wave function that's in WKB form, essentially. Or we'll use that analogy. And so it predicts classical histories that are the integral curves of the imaginary part of the action, that is the solutions to the momentum equals the gradient of S, and the probabilities, the leading order in H bar, are given essentially by the square of the wave function, which is e to the minus 2 times the value of IR for those histories, provided that the imaginary part of the action varies rapidly with respect to the real part of the action. That's the classicality condition. I'm not going to describe this, but that restricts the classical histories. We get no big empty universes, and in this model, all histories exhibit some scalar field driven inflation. Effectively, what we're doing to the classical phase space is to have the dimension, because from this relation, a point in classical phase space is specified by a P and a Q. But we have a relation between P and Q specified by the wave function. And so all the histories, the probabilities are zero in the semi-classical approximation, except on a surface that is in the phase space. And that will be generally true. Any sort of, there's a wide class of histories that predict classical spacetimes. Any WKB state that does that, like that predicts, restricts the classical phase space to a surface of half the number of dimensions. We can then do the same thing with fluctuations. I'm not going to go through the technology. But the results are not too surprising. So you perturb the system, you have linear fluctuations, you calculate the perturbations in these complex saddle points, you evaluate the classical histories, you calculate their probabilities, as we have described before, and the probabilities in a given background history, which is labeled by phi naught, the start of the, as you roll down approximately, of some gauge invariant measure of the fluctuations, is given by a very familiar formula, right, which is this, where this is the, these are the inflationary parameters. So these are the slow roll and the expansion parameters evaluated at the time when the mode leaves the horizon. That is, when n is equal to a star h. So this is essentially the Bunch-Davis vacuum. And that is not a surprise, right, because, although we could calculate corrections to it from the Bunch-Davis vacuum, because the Euclidean construction of the wave function means that the fields, right, calculate the state of the fields is essentially in their ground state, right? So we reproduce that, whoops. And then there's just the usual story. The fluctuations get large when this is bigger than 1 or when VQ, and that is what's usually interpreted as internal inflation. I think one has to admit that the perturbation theory at least is breaking down at this point, but the conclusion of others is that we get large. Space-like surfaces. So now we can try to calculate the probabilities of, for example, what we observe in the CMB. And we're going to do it by coarse graining, just like in these box models, by coarse graining over all the Hubble volumes. We're assuming we're on the reheating surface, except the one we're in, which could be any of them, right? So we're looking for the analog of this formula. So we're somewhere on the reheating surface in Hubble volume here. Here's us. Doesn't make any difference where we are. And the probability that we see a particular spectrum of the CMB is going to be the sum over all the histories, which the backgrounds, phi naught, and over an assumption, sum over all the unobserved large-scale fluctuations. In one Hubble volume, we only see fluctuations on the scale of the Hubble volume, so we have to coarse grain over all those. And now comes a particularly crucial assumption, which we're going to make. We will make an ansatz that that these probabilities, which are contingent on the superhorizon fluctuations, are the same as if the fluctuations weren't there. That is, we will ignore the back reaction on the reheating surface produced by the superhorizon fluctuations that left their horizons during a regime of eternal inflation. Every Hubble volume is then the same, and the coarse graining is therefore easy as it was in the yellow-green model. There's a certain amount of support for this ansatz that's provided, first of all, by the cosmic no-hair theorems that just say that, right? That the provided there's a sufficient number of e-folds after the exit from eternal inflation, then all the very long wavelength modes will be redshifted away, and we'll just be left with the, if we're interested in local observations, we'll just be left with the short wavelength ones. Since in this model for realistic values of m, we have a large number of e-folds afterwards, that seems reasonably safe. Also, explicit calculation in cases where you can deal with actually the big inhomogeneities on large scales, not these cosmological cases, and linear fluctuations on small scales, such as the work of Hertag and Turok a long time ago with the so-called Graton Turok and Hertag instanton, bubble instanton, where you can do the calculations explicitly, supports this. And recent calculations of Giddings and Sloth also, doing the same thing from a different perspective, also support the same thing. The important point, I think, it's not a new principle of quantum mechanics. It's a further measure, but it's a test untestable approximation. So that's how we would do the calculations in the CMB. Thanks. perfect. Now let me talk about a little bit about model landscapes. Of course, I don't know anything about string theory, right? So you'll just have to bear with me as I talk about a model landscape. So I'm going to assume that we have one potential, and it's got a lot of minima. And at each minima, there's so a minima is labeled by k, and we have lambda k, and each minimum has got some power, nk, and some coefficient of the power. And I'm going to assume, and this is important, that there are big potential barriers between them, and I'm going to neglect the tunneling, right, to leading order in the semi-classical approximation, which is what I'm working in. The objective is going to be to calculate, as we have some data D, right, and the objective is to calculate the probabilities, therefore, for these parameters which we can observe. Or, in other words, to answer the question, which minima are we in? Which minimum are we in? And again, I'm going to assume the no boundary wave function for illustration. And the argument proceeds, as Neil was stressing yesterday, by a series of selections for different landscape regions. First, we're assuming classicality, which is a manifest feature of our universe, and we allow a classical, we select for potentials that allow a classical realm at all. That is, for which the action, the imaginary part of the action, varies rapidly compared with the real part. We select for potentials that allow for eternal inflation because we saw that those dominate the probabilities. We select for histories around a given minimum that have the lowest exit for eternal inflation, because that's what the probabilities tell us, as I'll show you. And finally, we select anthropically for parameters consistent with our local data. So I'll run through these once more. The selection for classical realm, we need this form of the wave function, and I need to need a potential such that, as I mentioned, that this varies rapidly compared to that. We don't have a lot of evidence for this, but the numerical evidence for the things that we have calculated seems to show in the simple class of models that if this happens when the potential allows for slow roll inflation. It's not too steep. The selection for eternal inflation, well, I've already described that. The top-down weighting suppresses histories with small reheating surfaces generated by eternal inflation. That's just this formula here, where the small ones, the ones finite N2, is suppressed. The selection for the history that with the lowest exit of eternal inflation comes from just approximating the probabilities, which are approximately e to the pi divided by the value of the potential at the start of rolling down. And in each channel, it's going to be given by something like this. And it'll be biggest when phi 0 k is the smallest. So we have to be internally inflating, otherwise we suppressed it, or but it's the smallest value, the exit from internal inflation, that dominates those probabilities. Quadratic minima dominates. If we assume for a moment that the lambdas are approximately zero, which will certainly be still consistently true, and the mu's are approximately comparable, then in the region selected for classicality and EI, we can calculate the exit for internal inflation. And you get an expression for the probabilities that something like this is a function of the number. And so the fact that the mu's are comparable implies that the lowest value of this occurs for quadratic minima. And that, in principle, could lead to some calculation if we were happy with the calculation. Finally, there is anthropic selection. I've talked about this top-down weighting, and I said that it's negligible, but there was one case that it's not. If PE is exactly zero, that is, your probability to exist in any one of these minima is zero, then the top-down weighting is zero no matter what the number of Hubble volumes is. So that's traditional anthropic selection emerging here at some fundamental level by including observers as quantum physical systems within the universe. So anthropic reasoning is not some, in this way of looking at things, it's not some choice that we make. It's an inevitable consequence of treating the observers quantum mechanically, because they sometimes have a probability to exist that's too small. I'll just give one to close. I'll just give one example of this, and that's Weinberg's anthropic estimate of the cosmological constant. The probability of our data, given lambda and m, is the basis for traditional anthropic reasoning. Weinberg got good results by putting in the observed m and assuming a uniform prior for lambda. But Livio, Rees, Tegmark, and Rees showed, of course, that the results actually got worse if you let the amplitude of the fluctuation scan with uniform priors on both. So I plotted here lambda, q, galaxies by 13 gigayears, two big fluctuations lead to black holes. So the anthropically allowed regime is sort of like this. And since the a uniform prior would push you up here to, since we're talking about a uniform prior in lambda, which is an increasing prior in log lambda, it would push you up here, which would make the results work. That was Livio and Rees's point. But we don't have to use uniform prior because the no boundary wave function supplies the prior. So the probability for lambda m given d is the probability from Bayes, just lambda m, multiplied by the probability of lambda n. We already calculated that. It's e to the 1 over v, and in these ranges where lambda is negligible, it's approximately given by 1 over the fluctuation amplitude, which is comparable to m. Therefore, the no boundary wave function pays the lowest value of q in the anthropically allowed range, and this restores Weinberg's original anthropic argument for lambda by pushing us down to the lowest possible value that's consistent with the anthropic constraints. Well, here are my, that's, I want to have some things for discussion. These are my and I've only got 1 minute, main point again. If the universe is a quantum system, it has a quantum state. This applies bottom-up probabilities for alternative classical histories, and there's an ensemble of them. Observers in the universe are physical systems within it, and they only have a probability to exist, and you should try, in other words, the basic message of this talk is to take quantum mechanics seriously for all parts of the universe, not only the backgrounds, but also the observers. Probabilities for observation top-down are necessarily a condition of a description on the observational situation. And by coarse graining over everything outside the past Lie cone of our Hubble volume, probabilities for observation can be calculated even in the regime of large histories generated by EI without a further measure. That's the end of my talk, but I have a few more remarks, and I hope Alan will let me. Yesterday I was inspired. Oh, okay. I got confused on the signals, but it was just as well. Okay. There were very inspiring talks yesterday by Ben, Alan, and Neil, right? And I was surprised how much overlap there was. So I thought I would take a moment to say how we respond to Neil's challenges and then describe where we overlap and where we don't. IMHO, as they say. Okay, so Neil, I hope I copied Neil's challenges down right. Getting inflation at all. Well, we have we're not talking about the classical phase space. We have a special state, right? And whatever the state of the universe is, it is a special state. He complained about fine-tuned potentials. We have a landscape of potentials according to the string theorist, and various potentials are selected by classicality, potentials that exhibit EI, and by top-down weighting. So we have a mechanism for at least pointing us in the direction of some potentials. Small lambda, that's anthropically selected, as many people have said already. The measure problem? Well, we have quantum mechanics and coarse graining gives observational predictions without resorting to counting, which we tried to avoid. Reliance on anthropic arguments, he also has a defect of the system. They seem to be inevitable. They just occur, right, if you treat the whole system quantum mechanically because there's a probability for the observers to exist. Okay. So that's our response to Neil, who is, I don't know, he's not lurking in the back. And here I just want to say, I probably understand this imperfectly, but I'm going out on a limb here and say what I agree with, or can agree with, I think. So I agree with Neil that something besides classical phase spaces need to say that the universe is inflating. And I just explained what it is. I agree with Alan and several other people who said the solution to the measure problem will come from quantum mechanics and involve quantum gravity, as here. I agree with Ben, who said there was eternal inflation in our past in simple models, and that's indeed exactly what we showed in these simple models. I also agree with Alan that we haven't, he had a slide, I saw we were moving up in the world when Alan actually had a slide denouncing us. Right. We haven't yet, we didn't do say anything about the relative numbers of observers doing this or that, but we don't, not making the calculation that way by first counting, right? We're first doing the coarse graining, then making those predictions. Well, that's agree. Disagree. I don't think there's one classical space-time that's not supportable in quantum gravity in which various quantum events happen. Right? An ensemble of possible classical space-time. It won't surprise you that I don't think the measure has to be independent of the state. I'm saying it is the state. I don't think there's one meaning to the question of whether what it means to say the universe is inflates. I didn't go into this, but our bottom-up probabilities, if you ask what will the universe do independent of anything, our probabilities show that inflation is rare. If you ask what's the probability in our universe that is conditioned on the existence of that it inflates, the probability is high. So it's not so simple. I don't agree also with that anthropic arguments are a choice. We have to do them. Things I don't know yet. We didn't address the issue of what the large-scale mosaic structure, the multiverse, that's difficult. It appears to me not to be very well defined because of this issue of negligible probabilities. But it's, we might be able to do it. But we're focusing on the, only on the local observations, which are the things that are necessary to test the theory. The famous relation for the numbers of observers could be true in some measure, but it should be a consequence of quantum probabilities. And work by Guiri, Laser, Tegmark, and by me a long time ago show how if you start with quantum mechanical probabilities for single systems, you can calculate the probabilities for an ensemble of systems. Agreement with the quantum mechanical calculation done correctly would then be a criterion for the measure. So, is there a measure problem in inflationary cosmology? My answer to that is yes. But it's the problem of what is the quantum state of the universe. Thank you. Ben.
What's making your answers here unambiguous is that you have enough symmetry in all of the situations you considered that you know how to randomly choose a Hubble volume because all of the Hubble volumes are the same as each other. And I agree that once you do that, then, you know, tracing out over all the stuff outside the horizon is unambiguous. But I think if you go to your last model with your landscape potential, your reheating surface is infinite. And I think the probability that that will all be in one vacuum will be zero. And so I don't think your semi-classical approximation where you ignore tunneling will be a good one. And once that reheating surface is inhomogeneous, then it'll be ambiguous how to choose an arbitrary Hubble volume. Okay, so it's kind of something that's beyond your box models, and that's where the ambiguities that the rest of us worry about will arise. And I don't think they're going to be answered by just computing the wave function. I think there's some additional input that's going to be needed there.
You may be right. Now, let's see. Oh, no, I get the answer. Where am I? You may be right. This is what I would call the standard objection. The standard objection is you didn't do A, B, or C. When you do A, B, C, you're going to run into trouble. And so we have to do A, B, C. So I don't disagree with you. About the symmetry, I think at some level, in order to deal with infinite universes, there has to be some symmetry. Because if the universe just is able to keep on going out and it gets different and different and different, we'll never calculate anything without putting in some ad hoc thing that amounts to the symmetry. So if there's no symmetry of some kind, right, then I think we're doomed. But so I agree with you, we didn't do that. We may run into trouble. We'll have to see. Anybody else can just say standard objection and then sort of you know, say what it is. It will shorten the time.
Well, okay, I was certainly appreciate the ideas and the debates we've had about this. One possible consequence that seems to arise from this is because if, when you assume that it's dominated by eternal inflation, you're getting that the observational probabilities just come from these the bottom-up things. So they depend, you know, purely on the last stage that you roll down. So in
we
other
didn't
words,
assume that we tried to calculate it, right?
Right. Yeah, you calculate. Okay. So once you get that, then there's no more anthropics except the requirement that in each case you get an infinite number of observers. I mean, in each case you need eternal inflation. So if you have eternal inflation, and the eternal inflation is big enough to give, you know, observers. I mean, I guess if it gives any, it's going to give infinitely many. So as long as it gives observers, then it's going to be based purely on this bottom-up probability. So there doesn't seem to be anything there that selects for, you know, being biophilic or something. So in other words, I would guess that if you did have a landscape with different values of the cosmological constant, it would be much more probable. Well, you might have, you know, probabilities for cosmological constants quite a lot larger than ours, but and they might be, you know, they might tend to suppress life, but because the universe is so big, life and observers will occur at least somewhere. So it seems naively to me that your answer that you're getting is going to say that we would most likely see a much larger value of the cosmological constant because there's no suppression factor from, you know, how many observers or what the spatial density of observers is. All you require is that you at least get some, and surely we can have a cosmological constant maybe three orders of magnitude or four orders of magnitude bigger, and with eternal inflation there still would be things. So I think you've made a very testable prediction, and of course without knowing the landscape I can't test it, but I mean my guess is if you applied this to the landscape it would be observationally ruled out.
Our calculation was too crude, right? I mean, I assumed that there was eternal inflation or no eternal inflation. But, of course, there's some dependence on PE, which we can calculate. Right? Now, whether that's enough to... So there will be a survival survivor PE in the final calculation. So it's an approximation that I made. Whether the approximation allows for anthropic selection, well, we'll just have to let the chips fall where they may. But it's not... I, in order to get through the talk, I just took one approximation. Next question.
So, Jim, I'd like to clarify what your approach is. So it sounds like you're saying let's choose a state for the universe.
Sorry, what?
It sounds like your approach is to say let's choose a state for the universe, work out predictions.
Right.
If they conflict with data, that's okay. You just chuck the state out and find another one.
Cut your data out?
If your predictions conflict with data, you that's okay. You just throw your state out and find another
one. It's fine to throw the state out. Thank you. I thought you just throw the data out.
No.
there are some people that act like that.
So where, in the old days, and those include today for some of us, we thought inflation was going to help us explain the state of the universe. Mm-hmm. But it's so what role have you left for inflation in that capacity?
We're talking, I think, about some state that exists in space-time. We're talking about a state that predicts the space-time background. So it's a different notion of state. That's what I tried to emphasize right at the beginning. In other words, we're trying to adopt the probability that there's not like a fixed space-time, there's a state for the fields in it, although, you know, the no-boundary state also predicts the state of the field in any one background, but there's an ensemble of possible backgrounds. So it does predict the state of the fields, but then there's still the ensemble of backgrounds, which is what we're talking about, treated on an equal basis. In other words, we're trying to do the calculation, including quantum gravity, at some very low level. Not supposed to be doing that.
Your state is one in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, and all your probabilities are expectation values of some operators in the inner product of that Hilbert space.
No.
Will you go there with me or no?
No.
This is not the unique quantum state of the universe. There are other quantum states.
There are other quantum states of the universe. I mean, Alex has proposed one. Maybe others.
So. I mean, if this is a quantum theory that runs in the usual way of quantum theory, there's a dynamical equation, which is something like the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, and there are an infinite number of solutions of it. Anyway,
yeah.
If you agree that
That's
far.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. what's your point of view these days on how the state is selected? Is it just an experimental question?
No, how we, obviously not, I think.
But then if the Hilbert space, if the quantum theory allows an infinite number of alternative quantum states of the universe, how do we explain which one is the quantum state?
Is the state.
Because from your point of view, there is a unit. There is a real actual state.
It's like asking, how do you explain what the dynamics is? Right? Now, there's some people that say that there... There's some people that say that, for example, the string theory is the unique possible theory. If that's the case, then, you know, maybe the state is unique. And there are people that have said that there's a unique state that's connected to string theory from ADS-CFT, right? So I don't know the answers to those questions, right? But at the present moment, I'm sticking to the idea that the final theory consists of two parts, if you like, the Hamiltonian or the action or whatever replaces that in string theory, and a theory of the quantum state.
Let me ask more specifically. Have you investigated how robust the conclusions are you draw to the choice of state?
No. Because the calculations are not so easy to do. I had a hard enough time doing this. I agree that's an interesting thing to do.
Okay, I guess we'll take one more question, and then we'll go on. Matt.
So this may be the same question that Ben and Don tried to ask, but let me try to make it a little bit more quantitative, if I can. So in a landscape where there are bubbles forming, inside each bubble, there's an infinite number of Hubble volumes of whatever type. So your n is infinite for each of those. And therefore, as long as P sub E is not zero, n times P sub E is always very large.
P sub E?
P sub E, the probability of existing in that vacuum. As long as that's not zero, n times P is always large. So in that kind of model, you're always in your, I think it was the third case on one of your slides.
I'm having just a little more volume or something.
So in that kind of model, you're always in what I think was the third case on one of your slides, where n times p is large for. So in that case, all the probabilities are simply determined. There are these, what did you call them, top-down? They're just p of 1, p of 2, p of 3. In other words, they're determined completely by the state. There's no anthropic selection. There's nothing at all about the physics in these vacua. Is that correct?
It depends on whether there are other histories that, for example, suppose you have a bubble potential. Then there'll be a bunch of competing histories. So eternal inflation starts inside the false vacuum. Then you tunnel out. But there'll be a bunch of histories that start below that, below the exit. So those won't have an infinite number of Hubble volumes in them.
Well, as long as there's at least one bubble of each type, then there's an infinite number of Hubble volumes of each type. Because each bubble contains an infinite number.
We can discuss this afterwards. If you have to have a bubble, then that's true. But there's some probability for histories, as I understand it, where the thing was never in the false vacuum and it just rolled down. Those histories will be suppressed relative to the other ones. So it's approximately what you're saying, right, as far as the end result goes. So I think we just differ a little bit on that. Other questions?
I think we should go on now.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's thank Jim again.